Welcome, everybody, as we're back, sort of our second week back after our summer hiatus. And I want to thank Adrienne Clemensburg for sponsoring tonight's year in memory of her father, Bella Galfi, Dov Ben Shimshon Yosef. The Shama should have an aliyah. The yahrzeit, I think, was a couple of weeks ago, 10 days ago or so. So we want to wish well and thank you. And we should all have good health and happy occasions to celebrate. Okay, Dr. Mark, I think we're well into 8:31.
Okay, very good. Hello, everyone. It's part two, but it's really not part two. I think it's part 20, if I'm not mistaken. Some people last week was the first week, so I said to them when they contacted me, you got to go back on the Torah in Motion website if you want to learn more about these people we mentioned, because we're just picking right up.
And we're in the fourth quarter, we had a break, you know, so...
Yes, I do want to pick right up. I have a bunch of things here. Well, I'll go about 10, 15 minutes, and then whatever I don't get to, I'll get to next class. Because first for Moshe, I thank you for your comment here. He pointed out something ironic. I was saying how I appreciate how Art Scroll doesn't use the yeshivish pronunciation, Horios or Eruchid, and I actually use the yeshivish pronunciation, summoning my Girsu the Yankusa from my youth. I called it Yuma, when it's actually Yoma. So, but in yeshivas, of course, you know, everyone says Yuma. So I said Yuma also. So thank you, Moshe. And I said, in response to that, I'm going to say something about another tractate that's, I'm not going to say mispronounced, although the Vilna Gaon thought it was. I first heard this when I was in yeshiva, that Beya instead of Beitza. So what's this in yeshivas? They Beya. That's, well, believe it or not, and we're adult audience here, I'll say the Yamshel Shlomo, where Shlomo Luria says that because the word Beitza, Beitzim, has another meaning, and Devar Maguna, you shouldn't testicles. It's not appropriate to say it. That's mentioned by the Magen Avraham also. So that's where the minhag apparently came from, not to refer to it as beitza. Although the word beitza appears in the Torah, in Tanakh. I can't remember now if it's in the Torah or not, but it's certainly, as I recall, in Tanakh. It's Efrachim Beitzim. Yes, I think it's my parsha. The Chasam Sofer is opposed to this, others, the Vilna Gaon is opposed to it, but that's the name, Beitza. By the way, Mosada Rav Kook did something interesting. Let me show you this. Hold on a second. I got to pull it up on my screen here. I had it a second ago, and now it's gone. I'm going to show you something here. Well, there's a rabbi, Besalo Ronsberg. He was a rav in, important rav in Prague. And he wrote a sefer. And the name of the sefer is Pitchei Nida. Here's the title page of it, the manuscript. That's the name of it. But Mosad HaRav Kook, I guess, is dainty or whatever it is. They gave it a different name. Chachamas Betzalo, and only put Pisle Nita in the subtitle. They invented this title, Chachamas Betzalo. So that, I think, is of interest. Okay, I want to talk about a couple other things before we begin. We spoke a lot about music in the synagogue. In fact, I think I'm going to come back to it a little bit later, but we spoke a lot about it, and I spoke also how in the modern Orthodox world, music has come into the synagogue now at various times. And I have to tell you now, it's not just the modern Orthodox world, it's also the Haredi world. What am I talking about? Slichos. First, there's been a reform in Slichos in a different way. And Maishol finally, what's the expression, bit the bullet or something this year. Slichos were 10 p.m. Two nights ago. For years, only one of the shuls in the area was doing it. Now it seems that this has become very popular, Saturday night, Motzei Shabbos, to do it. Really, the only reason you wait to Chatzos, which is not midnight, Chatzos is like 12:55 where I am. It's very hard. There's Kabbalistic reasons. It goes back to the Ari and others. And that became the general Minhag, except for in Manhattan, there were shuls that always, since the 70s, it wasn't dangerous, and it's still not, it's still dangerous now. So, they would not do it at Chatzos, but that seems to be happening. But what also seems to be happening is that there is a lot of, musical, slichos. So I just, earlier today, I went on YouTube and I'll show you some of what I found. Actually, I found something interesting. A women's musical slichot from London. Oh, hold on. I don't know if I make the sound. Let's see a second here. Let me stop sharing this. I have to give you sound for all these things. Here.
השיר הזו אביע רננות ועל מפנה.
Okay, but here's what I find really interesting. Not modern Orthodox. Charedi. Sorry, it's...
What is Kabbalah? How is it connected to the Word of God?
For some reason, I'm not getting sound here to show you, but you get the picture here. I don't know why I'm not getting sound coming out of my computer. It never happened before, but just take a look at the pictures. Okay, sorry about that. I don't know what the problem is, but take my word for it. You would have heard good music from Haredi World, Slichos. It was working before. I don't know what happened to my sound. This led this week, earlier, end of last week, to the Gedolim in Eretz Yisrael in the Haredi world, released a letter banning all these slicho services with music and instruments. I don't know if that can work, if that's possible, because it's become so such a big deal now that I don't know if it's even possible to stop them. Let me see if I can. Yeah, I don't know what's going on here with my computer. Okay, as long as you can hear me, that's good. Okay, I wanted to call that to your attention. Now, the next thing I want to mention before we begin is we have 5 more minutes. I listened to my class, the last class before the break, and I saw something was completely unclear. So I want to share that with you again. We were talking about a Geiger and we're talking about... he called attention to certain verses that he thought were incorrect in our text. And we spoke a little about lower criticism, Torah perspectives on lower criticism. And I gave you an example, and it wasn't clear. So I want to give you the example again here and then mention something else. This is the pasuk I was referring to. It says in chapter 19, verse 33, V'chi agur itcha ger ba'artzachem. I was all confused in what I was saying. The issue is, the question is as follows. It says, V'chi agur itcha. Singular, ger b'artzachem, plural. Why is it say singular itcha and then artzachem plural? The Or HaChaim asked this question. And what I mentioned was that if you look in the Bavli, in Yerushalmi, in the Samaritan Pentateuch, in the Targum, in Unkelus, Yonatan, Neophiti, Septuagint, Vulgate, Peshitta, etc., what you find is that it doesn't say, it says itchem, v'chi agur itchem, ger b'artzachem. So that would be an example of perhaps where you're not going to change your Sifrei Torah, but you can say that the Masoretic text doesn't necessarily preserve the authentic version. There's another version. So that's what I was referring to. Now, this got me thinking, because I didn't mention, Geiger actually called attention to another example of where he thought that the Masoretic text was changed. So let me show it to you here. It's a verse we all know here. Take a look. You probably never thought of it, though, but it's in Bereishis, chapter 27, verse 12. Remember, Rivka is convince Yaakov that he has to dress up to go get the blessing from his father. So what does Yaakov say? He says to her that perhaps my father will feel me, and I will see Hayisi be'enav kimsatea. I'll be like a mocker. V'hevesi alai kolav lo bracha, and I shall bring a curse upon me, not a blessing. Geiger points out that in some manuscripts of the Samaritan Pentateuch, and also in the Peshitta, which is the Syriac translation, it reads as follows. Not v'hevesi alai kolav, I'll bring a curse unto me. V'hevesa alai kolav. Yaakov says that you will be, I will be like a mocker to him, and by doing this, you, namely Rivka, will bring a curse upon me. So that's interesting. Although Rav Chaim Heller, he disagrees with this. He takes this up. You can check out Rav Chaim Heller if you want in his Nusach Targumim B'Torah, page 35. He says this is definitely incorrect by Geiger, but that was Geiger's point. While I was right before class, that reminded me of something else that you all remember the big Talmud Chacham who we spoke about a lot a few semesters ago, or Yaakov Kapel Schwartz. There he is with me, who, although he has the traditional look, he often says things that are very interesting and unusual. In his Likutei Diborim, which is his weekly parsha, Dvar Torah is his shir. They put it together every year. So this is 2022, volume 7, page 51. He says something incredible. You recall when he picks up the issue of when Yaakov Yitzhak was going down in. Yaakov hid Dina. When Yaakov was going to meet Esav, it says that Yaakov hid Dina so that Esav wouldn't see her and want to marry her. And by the way, Rabbi Schwartz deals with is there's some Chazal that criticize Yaakov. They say that he should have let her marry him, and then she could have had a good influence. But we also have a passage in the Gemara that tells us you're not supposed to let your daughter marry an Amoritz. So, and Esav isn't just Amoritz, he's worse than that. So, Rabbi Schwartz deals with this conflict. But he says, listen to this. Remember, Rashi quotes this Midrash. It says, Vedina Hecha and Haisa, where was Dina? He says, Nesana Bateva, Venal Befana, Shelo Yitain Ba Esav Einav. And he covered her up so that Esav wouldn't see her. And then won her. And then Rashi continues that because that Yaakov was punished, which is an amazing thing with this idea. We have to figure out why we're being told that Yaakov should have let her take Esav, let Esav take her. But Rabbi Schwartz says that he thinks that really the Baal HaMidrash altered the truth out of kavod to Dina or Yaakov, and really what he's saying is as follows. What does it mean? Dina, where was she? He says he put her in a box. Why? Not Shelo Yitain Ba Esav Einav, not that Esav wouldn't see her and want her, but that Dina would see Esav and be impressed with Esav, and as a young teenage girl, whatever, she'd want to be with the cool guy Esav, and therefore that's what was going on here. And then he goes off in Drash, explaining how when we raise children, we can't just close them off. We can't just, forbid them from everything. You have to let them out in the world and make their decisions and hope you've given them a good education, a good chinuch. But I think it's really fascinating that Rabbi Schwartz thinks that the point of the Midrash, we're expected to understand it, that it's really the problem here was Dina. Dina was going to be impressed by Esav, not Esav the other way. Okay, I have other things to get to, but I see the hour is already late. About the order that we spoke about of the chapters in the Quran, and also wait till you hear what Louis Ginsberg has to say. And did it ever occur to you that maybe in earlier days we davened five times a day, not three times a day? So we'll get to that next class. But right now, let's pick up where we were. Let's pick up right where we left off. I said, we're going to go right into the rabbinic conferences in Germany. And the last thing we were speaking about was really the Abraham Cohen, his assassination. He definitely was killed. They found arsenic. But who did it? Why? I have to say that when I listened to the tape also, I wasn't exact. I said a couple times there was no evidence that Pilpel, the Jewish guy, killed him. That's not correct. He was convicted. So there was circumstantial evidence, or there was there wasn't conclusive evidence because it was overturned. But when someone is convicted even once, there's some sort of evidence. It might not be rock solid evidence, but there was at least someone who said he looks like him, this and that sort of thing. But they presented it wasn't just anti-Semitism. The prosecution presented a case. By the way, when Popo was found innocent, the non-Orthodox community was outraged. They assumed that he was guilty and that this was a miscarriage of justice. But I want to now speak about these rabbinic conferences, three rabbinic conferences, 1844, 45, 46. They didn't continue after that. There was supposed to be one in 47, and they couldn't get the act together. And 48, of course, is the year of revolution. And after that, people were not interested in it. But what were these three conferences? Let's refresh our memory again. The first one, 1847, we know it as Brunswick, but Braunschweig. In 1845 is Frankfurt, and in Breslau in 1846. And as I said, these set forth the principles of this movement now that's going to be known as Reform Judaism. So what happened? Well, first of all, these were young rabbis. Most were in their 30s. As I said, rabbis and preachers in both small towns and also large cities. Now, some rabbis who were going to attend, never attended in the end when they saw who was attending and that it was going to be more radical than they expected. In fact, in Bavaria, the rabbis were not even permitted to attend by the government because the government was convinced that this was going to be a radical movement. Who convinced them? The Orthodox. At this first conference, there was a spectrum of views, a number of views. Some rabbis there believed in the authority of the Torah and the Talmud. And they just have to make little changes. And Michael Meyer tells us that these people were easily visible because they kept their heads covered. They were wearing yarmulke. And they were generally outvoted. Among the issues voted on at the Brunswick conference was Kol Nidrei. And that was not a controversial one. The assembly voted the rabbi should try to get rid of it. As far as I know, no Reform temple to this day has Kol Nidrei. We spoke about how even Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, for 1 year when he was rabbi in Oldenburg, he got rid of it as well. Kol Nidrei's always been a source for anti-Semitic attacks that you can't trust the Jews because their oaths are of no value, because here they free themselves of oaths on Yom Kippur. And there's a dispute. Is it the past tense or the present tense? So now they do both, all the oaths from the past year and the future year. So the Reform are only too happy to get rid of it. So I see Eric says that today Reform synagogues do have Kol Nidrei. Maybe they like the song. You know, it is part of our tradition. And by the way, it's not just Ashkenazic shuls. I can play you, as I figure out what's going on with my computer here, an audio of a chazan in Tunisia. And the Kol Nidrei that he uses sounds just like our Kol Nidrei. There's someone in Jerusalem who's collecting all these tunes from Kol Nidrei, for all these tunes from Tunisia. They had some big chazan in there. So it's the same thing. I don't know. I assume it's an Ashkenazic tune that made its way to Tunisia, though. Not maybe just because the French, when they came in. I can't imagine that it's that this is more than 300 years old. I don't think it goes back to the Mariel or anything like that, but I could be wrong. Now, they also took a vote and had deliberations on a much more controversial matter, that of mixed marriage. There was a rabbi there, Reform Rabbi Ludwig Philipson, and he put forth the proposal that the rabbis in Brunswick should take up this issue and conclude the same way that the French Sanhedrin had concluded. Napoleon, who created this French Sanhedrin, which had at least one, I think two, Gedol Yisrael. I mean, the head of it was the Yad David, Yosef David Sinzheim, one of the real Gedolim. he was there, and they tried to thread the needle here because they couldn't appear unpatriotic, un-French. On the other hand, they had to be in line with halakha. So their conclusion, which they gave to Napoleon, was that mixed marriage is civilly valid, but it's not religiously valid. It's not religiously valid. It can't be given religious sanction, which is just what we'd say today in America. What do we think about mixed marriage? It's recognized civilly. We recognize it. We understand it's there, but it doesn't have a religious sanction. We don't give a religious sanction. These days, we don't even bat an eye, because other than the Orthodox world, the mixed marriage is everywhere. I mean, it's not like anyone's going to mention that Zeldin is mixed married. And, I mean, this used to be an issue, but today we recognize that, it's not a moral issue. It's not a communal issue in the sense that people are rejecting Judaism, Jewish people. These people don't know any better. If you try to convince a non-Orthodox person that there's something wrong with intermarriage, they won't understand what you're talking about. And from their perspective, this is a big kiddush Hashem, because now non-Jews are married with Jews, and therefore they're exposed to Judaism, all that. That's just the world we're in. There were those in Brunswick who thought that they should permit mixed marriage, l'chachila, permit it. But this was not the majority position. Here is the text of the resolution that was passed about mixed marriage. It goes further than the French Sanhedrin, though. Remember, the French Sanhedrin said, we recognize that it's civilly valid. We can't give religious sanction to it. This is what it says, quote, the marriage of a Jew with a Christian, marriage with adherents of monotheistic religions in general, is not prohibited, provided that the laws of the state permit parents to raise the children of such a union also in the Jewish faith. So in Brunswick, they actually did permit intermarriage as long as the children would be raised in the Jewish faith. Now, what this means, first of all, they didn't recognize patrilineal descent. So they have to assume that the mother is Jewish, the wife is Jewish, or the child will be converted. So that's not a problem. They can convert the child, the reform can convert the child. But it's only theoretical, because at this time, there were no Jewish German states where children of a mixed marriage were allowed to be raised as Jews. They were not allowed to. If one of the partners was not Jewish, they had to be raised as Christians, sent to the Christian school, be registered as a Christian, etc. So they were putting forth a liberal idea. Not everyone agreed with it, but the majority did, knowing that it had no practical implications. And therefore, Judaism is secure. They're not recognizing intermarriage, but in theory, the time will come when it is to recognize. And we know that even after the conference, there were those reform who regretted this formulation, including radical reformers. David Einhorn, who's one of the real radical reformers, regretted this. He said that if you permit intermarriage, that's the end of Judaism. And Reform Judaism as a whole did not, until the 20th century, until I guess the 70s of the 20th century, Reform Judaism did not accept the decision at the Brunswick Conference to accept intermarriage. It was only in the 70s that, even in the 70s, it wasn't so popular. Now it's standard, but it wasn't so. It took another over 100 years. Now, as can be expected, the Brunswick Conference led to an Orthodox response. A number of books were published about it. Here is one book. Let me show you some of that was published about it. Parata Knaot, published in Amsterdam. Published with lots of letters of different rabbis. By the way, one of the letters in here, the second letter, you can see it here, written by none other, very nice letter, Shimshon Ben Rafael Hirsch. We know him as Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, but you see his name when he signed it, Ben Adoni Avi Rafael Hirsch. From Frankfurt, now in Emden. He was a rabbi then in Emden. So his I have to check his father then No, sorry. No, Rafal Hurst Frankfurter. That's the name. Living in Emden. He didn't write much when he was in Emden, but that's what he wrote. But look what before I get to what Hirsch has to say, on page 2, which is the letter of a number of rabbis here, the German rabbis, one we spoke about, Sibin Yelan Auerbach and others, including one from Michelstadt. If you've been to Michelstadt, when we used to go to Germany, we go there because there's a great tzaddik there who's buried there, known as the Baal Shem of Michelstadt, and it's definitely worth going there. What do they say in this letter? They say a few things. First of all, they said in number Aleph, they said that of these people, they don't know anything about Torah. They've never studied. They're not Tamei Chachamim. They're supposed to be able to decide. Then they go on and says that all the rabbis in every city accept the fact that you have to follow the laws of the Talmud. And you're going to listen to these people. What do these people know? And then they go on to say that he speaks about how the fact that you can't change halacha, that once it's accepted in the Gemara, it can't be changed. Now, in the note here, they pick up on the fact that one of the reform documents called attention to Rav Yosef Albo. Rav Yosef Albo has an interesting view. He differs with the Rambam's ninth principle. The Rambam's ninth principle says that the Torah can never be mitzvos, can never be revoked. The Torah can never be altered. It's eternal. And Rav Yosef Albo doesn't see this as an ikar. On the contrary, he thinks, so what's the problem? If God wants to send another revelation, but it would have to be a revelation, just like the first revelation, a public revelation everyone can see. If God wanted to do that, he could do that. And he could issue us another Torah. You can't change the Torah, but if God wants to, who are we to tell God? So one of these reform individuals had cited the Sefer Ikarim of Yosef Albo to say that, well, not everyone agrees with the Rambam, and Rav Yosef Albo said that Jewish law could change, therefore we could change it. So he points out in the notes there that this is sheker, completely sheker. Ha'ikarim lo diber muma, ki'im inyanim asher nishtanu al pikudas Hashem. Or if it's hinted to in the Torah, etc., that it shouldn't be done in today's day and age. Like if we don't have the base of Migdash, we can't do sacrifices. So he says the Ikarim only spoke about matters that if God himself changes it. That's the first document, document published. But there was more. Another book appeared. Here it is. Kinat Sion, also published in Amsterdam, with a number of tshuvot by different rabbis, Sephardic rabbis also dealing with this matter. And I want to show you something because history repeats itself. On page 12 in this book, you have a responsum of Rav Yisrael Moshe Chazan, an individual we spoke about numerous times, and he says as follows, that, first of all, he quotes, let me show you something, he quotes a Rashi. The Rashi says in, where is this? In Vayikra, chapter 26, you have a pasuk here. If you do not listen to me and do not perform all these commandments. And then, that's not the pasuk. The next pasuk. If you despise my statutes and reject my ordinances. Rashi goes on and explains this, that what does it mean at the end that you break my covenant? And he explains that if you deny the main tenet of Judaism, and then Rashi says that this verse, if you look closely, you can figure out there's seven sins there. The first leads to the second, and then it goes on until you get to the end, you deny God itself. The point being that when you begin small, you begin denying little things, and then you're going to lead, you'll deny the big things. And that's, of course, been the pattern of reform. You start with the small things, and then you end up denying big things. Then he goes on. This is many, many pages in this of Sefer and of Yisrael Moshe Chazan. But on page 12, he says about the reformers, he says, listen to this. He says they speak negatively about Judaism and also of those who, also about those who are in live in Admas HaKodesh, Kosvim Devarim Ra'im Shkarim Mechazavim, they speak bad about Eretz Yisrael. He talks about how the reformers in the mid-19th century were talking. Now, they're talking about Eretz Yisrael in a different way. They're saying that we don't need Eretz Yisrael. We don't want Eretz Yisrael. Germany's our future. They reject the whole idea of return to the land of Israel. But really, this becomes a theme in Reform Judaism. Until World War II, mainstream Reform Judaism was anti-Zionist. Then they do become Zionists, and you have Stephen Wise and Abihail Silver, they are Zionists. But today as well, you have to say that although officially they're Zionists, there are many in the Reform movement who now are turning anti-Zionist against Israel in the most left-wing and anti-Israel ways. We had a couple years ago, right before COVID, a big rally. Very, the sort of thing that the Haredim wouldn't do, but we all did it. All the modern Orthodox shuls, the conservative shuls, and the Reform shuls. Local to get together in Livingston, New Jersey on, it was a beautiful Sunday afternoon on the town hall there. The mayor spoke, a few of the different mayors, and a congressperson, as I recall, just in support of Israel. I'm not sure why, but it was like a support for Israel Day. They were having Israel food, everything. The Reform Synagogue in the area, one of the Reform synagogues, backed out of it because they thought that it wouldn't be even-handed. Now, again, this was a rally in support of Israel, and the local Reform synagogue here said that it wouldn't be even-handed, and therefore they backed out. So that's unfortunately what we're dealing with, and Yisro Moshe Chazan was dealing with it already years ago. And also of interest, you have in this book, Kinat Tzion, a letter from a rabbi in Sfat, one of the Meshulachim. At the end of the letter, he says as follows, Shimu Moachim, Hazinu Rosanim, listen, kings, and pay attention, princes. What does he say to them? Arise, you know, come to the defense of the Jews. He says, Ridfu Achareim Biyad Ramah, Radfam Ad Charma. He says to the kings and the princes and the government that you should persecute these reformers. Why? Because Ki Mardu Bataras Moshe Biyad Ramah. We spoke how this was in the first generation of Reform. This was something, a tactic of the Orthodox. Now, this is the second generation. You have no, there are no people in the, in Germany arguing this. And for the simple reason that by the second generation, the Reform are the majority. So if you're going to talk about that the you should persecute for religion, then it's the Orthodox who are going to be persecuted. And in fact, in Frankfurt, the Reform did persecute the Orthodox in terms of institutions and distributions of funds. But here you have a rabbi from the land of Israel. He doesn't know the situation. And he's writing that we should get the government involved to shut down these Reform synagogues. That maybe would work in the first generation. But now if the government's going to do anything, the Reform are the majority in the big cities. So that's of interest. Now, the last, by the way, when I forgot to mention, so when Shamshon Raphael Hirsch is in Emden, he's there from 1841 to 1847, and he hardly wrote anything. But that's during the time that he applied. We were speaking about the Queen before. The royal family in England has always had a good relationship with the Jewish leaders. And I believe it continues. The tradition always was that the males in the royal family were circumcised. That's what it definitely was in the 19th century. I don't know if it continues to this day, but it was always a big deal because the only people circumcised in England were the royal family and the Jews. But there's always been this connection. And the first chief rabbi of, well, I guess it's Solomon Herschel, but often they say the first chief rabbi of the modern era or the United Synagogue was Nathan Marcus Adler. So he's elected chief rabbi 1845 or 46, I forget the year, but Shamshon Raphael Hirsch ran against Adler in this election. And it's interesting to think of counter history. Had Hirsch won, Nathan Marcus Adler was also from Germany, and he had a PhD. I believe he's the first PhD ever awarded to a German rabbi, is Nathan Marcus Adler. I located the PhD, and I have a copy of it in Erlangen, Germany. And he's the first one. It's interesting to speculate how, if Hirsch had come to England, how that would have affected English Jewry. He would have written, of course, then in English. It would have been very different. But he lost, and he lost poorly. He received all of 2 votes, and Nathan Marcus Adler received 121. When from where we're standing now, Hirsch, of course, is much more important and has a much greater influence than Nathan Marcus Adler, although even during their lifetimes, Hirsch becomes more important. But whatever it is, the people in England were much more impressed. Maybe Nathan Marcus Adler knew English. I don't know. And Hirsch, I don't know. But whatever it is, they were not impressed. Now, this is before he was in Nicholsburg. He still was an unknown rabbi. Later, when he's in Nicholsburg, he's the chief rabbi of Moravia. Had he run against Adler when he was chief rabbi of Moravia? He had like 32 communities under him. That's the last place he was before he went to Frankfurt. People couldn't believe he's giving up chief rabbi of Moravia to come basically for a little breakaway minion in Frankfurt. Had he been chief rabbi of Moravia running against Adler, then he was already then famous. He was a known entity. He had written 19 letters. Then I think it would have been different. But now already he wasn't known. And Nathan Marcus Adler is the author of the commentary, the Tinal and the Sinologer, well-known Talmud Chacham, so I understand it. Now, this Kinatzione shows, of course, is written in response to the Brunswick Conference, but there's another work. Oh, before I read you what Meyer has to say, because Meyer discusses these writings. He says something not about the writings, although he does discuss it. He points out something interesting, that the Orthodox are attacking the Reformers. They were opposed to all the reforms for obvious reasons. But he says that the Christian missionaries also oppose these conferences, because the Christian missionaries, not that they could have any influence on it, but they didn't like reformers because they saw religious reform as dangerous to their cause. Because only an Orthodox Jew, they said, is likely to become an Orthodox Christian. If you're a Reformed Jew, then already you're skeptical. You're not really a believer in revelation in a traditional sense. Often, you could even be a deist. Many of them. If you get an Orthodox Jew who actually believes in revelation, believes in the Torah, and then you convince him that the New Testament is the coming to fruition of the Torah, he's going to be an Orthodox Christian. But a non-Orthodox Jew is not going to become an Orthodox Christian. So that's an interesting point. There was another response to the Brunswick Conference, another book, and that's this one here. Tosafos Magula, and doesn't have on the title page who it's written, but it's written by this individual. Shir, Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport of Prague, also someone we've spoken about a lot of times. He is, although he looks like an old-fashioned Hasidish or Rav or a traditionalist, he is you got to call him a modern Orthodox rabbi. He's a maskil, a religious maskil, but a maskil. He is the son of the Ksos HaChoshen. He was a gon, but also a maskil, no question about it. Chasam Sofer, for some reason, got along well with him, but he was definitely a Moscow. I've said many times that I like that picture. Let me show you the picture again, because we have many Haredi rabbis who look modern. That is, they're clean shaven. They wear regular suits. What we don't have is we don't have modern Orthodox rabbis who look like Hasidim or Haredim. So I like this, and I think we should have. Why not have, maybe among the neo-Hasidim today you have that, but have someone with a Shtreimel and a Bekesha, but a complete modern Orthodox Jew, that would be nice. So when I look at Shir, Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport, we always go to his kever, because it's right next to the Noda Yehuda. In Prague, I like to talk about Shlomo Yehuda Rappaport. He beat out Maritz Chayes for that rabbinic position in Prague. Prague always wanted modern rabbis. So he has this little book, which is in response to the Brunswick Conference, but also it's written to those attending the Frankfurt Conference, telling them, these are the mistakes of the Brunswick Conference. Don't make these mistakes. Of course, he explains, as you can imagine, that Jewish law can't be gotten rid of. We don't have the authority. It's only the Talmud has the authority. But he makes a few interesting points. On page 14, he says that he doesn't understand, since the whole point of the conference is to get rid of Jewish law, why it's a conference of rabbis. He says, if it's a conference dealing with Jewish law, so then you need rabbis to deal with halakha things. But since the whole idea is to get rid of Jewish law, why do you need rabbis here? He says it's like if you're going to have a get together, a group of people to tear down a house, you don't need to bring architects in. You just bring in the bulldozer and tear it down. He's like mocking them. He's saying, why is it a rabbinic conference if you're not doing anything rabbinic? You're just getting rid of Jewish law. For that, we don't need rabbis. That's an interesting point. And then on page 20, he says, he picks up the intermarriage thing. And he says to them so you don't want to accept rabbinic law. But you say that you accept the Torah, but if you look in Devarim, chapter 7, verse 4, it has a pasuk that don't make marriages verse 3, with these non-Israelites. Why? Because verse 4, ki yasir espincha me'acharai. Can you make these marriages? Your child will be turned away from following me. So Reform rabbis, how can you permit mixed marriages? You're leading the Jewish people. They're not going to be any more Jewish people. Obvious point, but he has to point it out. And then, in the last paragraph, you see he's perhaps different than, he's Hirsch, we said, also said that in modern times, we don't want to bring the government involved, because this is what he says. His very last paragraph. So what should the Yoreim and the Ksherim, that is, what should the Orthodox do with the reformers? Yochamuna gam b'kochem amshala? Should we bring the government in on this? Which, of course, as I said, it won't even help now because the reformers are the majority in certain places, in the big cities, definitely. He says, Chaliga v'chaliga. He says, God forbid, this is not what we should do. But he says, not just for tactical reasons. He says, this is not what Chazal want us to do. And he brings a proof here. The proof is as follows. In Tractate Gittin 7a, it talks about how Mar Ukva was having problems. People were giving him all sorts of tsaras. So he sent a letter to Rabbi Elazar. He says, what do I do with the people who stand over and torment me? I have the power to deliver them into the hands of the government. What's the halacha? Can I deliver them to the government? Rabbi Elazar wrote to him and said, don't do that. He derives from a verse, even though the wicked's before me, I will keep a curb on my mouth. In other words, we don't turn other Jews into the government. And then Mar Ukva wrote back to him again that they're tormenting me a great deal. I can turn him into the government. So what is the answer he was given? Rise before and stay later than them in your visits to the study hall. They will disappear on their own. That's what the Gemara says. Shkem v'harev alein lebeis hamidrash. That's what the Gemara says to deal with these sort of people. That is, we do what we do. We leave religious life. We go to the base medrash. We go to shul. We do what we do. They will disappear on their own. We don't need to fight with them. And that's the solution, he says. And maybe it is a good solution. I mean, all these fighting, just ignore them. I know that there are many in the Orthodox at this time who are not engaged in polemics. Their attitude was just ignore them. They'll go away on their own. Okay, so that's the Brunswick. Now, the second conference is Frankfurt in 1845. And by the way, the Brunswick conference is 8 days. Can you imagine a rabbinic conference 8 days? How long are conferences today? 2 days, 3 days at the most? When I say 3 days, it's like two. You get there one day, so it's half a day, then a full day, and a half a day. 8 days. Well, the Frankfurt Conference is 14 days. Now, I get it if it was at a fancy resort or something, but it's not. It's just that I guess that was their vacation. But so 14 days conference. Now, Geiger was at this conference, and together with him, most of the attendees felt that Hebrew had outlived its time. That now we need to turn the prayers into German. They took a vote and they voted that there's no legal necessity for German prayers. We spoke about this with the Hamburg prayer book already, that we know. But they did say that for emotional reasons, we can't have the prayers entirely in German. So for instance, they would have lots of prayers in German, but then they'll have some. So Shema, you're not going to say the Shema in German. Not yet say in Hebrew. Certain prayers you have to say in Hebrew. I think the most Reformed synagogue in America, even now, of course, they're more traditional. They brought back a lot of Hebrew. But even in the heyday, let's say in the 50s and the 60s, the 40s, when they were really Reform, I assume that there'd be some, a few mentions of Hebrew here and there. So for nostalgic reasons or for emotional reasons, you need to have some Hebrew there. This idea of emotional reasons reminds me of something else. The conservative movement ruled, the Committee on Jewish Law, that you can use non-Jewish wine, that we don't have pagans among us using it for idolatry. Assuming it's not idolatry, what goes on with the Eucharist. And therefore, since we don't have wine being used for idolatry, therefore, there's no prohibition anymore. So, true, there's another reason given to prevent intermarriage, but okay, they get around that also, because that seems to be a later reason added, whatever. However, they also say in their ruling that for sacramental purposes, that is, let's say for Kiddush, you should only use Jewish wine. And why? If all wine is good, if all wine is kosher, then all wine is good. So they say that it's basically the same thing for emotional reasons, that the idea of kosher wine should at least remain as for Kiddush. Other than that, you don't need to, but Kiddush is okay. What else did the conference in Frankfurt take up? Well, they took up the coming of the Messiah, the return to Zion, which we saw that Rabbi Moshe Chazan spoke about. And the general sentiment there was that we believe in the messianic idea 100%. And this differentiates us from Christianity, because we do not believe the Messiah came or has come. Not at all. The Messiah hasn't come. The old joke is that Jews and Christians are arguing about this. So when the Messiah comes, they ask him, is this your first time here or your second time here? Until then, Jews can get along. I heard that joke the same time I heard the joke that was said. I know people like Yitz Greenberg would be upset with this joke, but this is what they said. That, you know what interfaith dialogue is? Jews who don't care that much about Judaism, talking to Christians who don't care that much about Christianity, and finding that they have a lot they agree on. So I don't agree with that joke. It's because I know some of the people involved in interfaith dialogue, and they definitely take Judaism seriously. But that's, I heard that joke the same time I heard the other joke. So yes, they affirm that we believe in the messianic idea. However, the messianic idea is not to be understood as in years past. There will be no return to Zion. There's no longer a political element here. We have no desire to return to the land of Israel, to create build a temple there. No, as we spoke a little bit about this last semester, the messianic idea is a universal idea that there will be peace. There's not going to be an individual Messiah. The idea of an individual messianic figure is unimportant, but the idea that the day is coming where nations shall no longer lift up a sword against nation, and there'll be no violence, and there'll be peace in the world, which they saw as coming. They saw that they were coming in that direction. Things looked okay. They thought that Western Europe had moved far from barbarism in the 19th century, and the rest of the world would follow. So that's what the messianic idea is. And it's important to them. They believe it. And remember, the messianic idea puts the idea of optimism there, that we have a better world to look forward to, something that's coming. It'll be better. This is the way they formulated the decision. Quote, the messianic idea deserves a significant role in our prayers, but the petitions for our return to the land of our fathers and the establishment of a Jewish state should be eliminated from them. So no more notion of returning. Now, what about all the passages in the prophets that speak about a return to the land of Israel? Because the prophets, they were in an era where they're living among pagans and evil people. And the only way they could have a complete Jewish life is returning to the land of Israel, where they could then be masters of their own destiny. But we, however, are living in a monotheistic world where people respect us, and therefore the language used by the prophets is no longer relevant to us. And furthermore, if we were to leave our countries and go to the land of Israel, then we're shirking our responsibility, this mission, the notion of the mission of Israel, which we spoke about, that the reformers put a great deal of stress on, that our job is to help bring knowledge of monotheism and of morality to the world. Look, you can find precursors to this idea, as I said, in Mendelssohn. Even Hirsch spoke about it, but it really comes into its own in the conferences. Ludwig Philipson says, quote, every people has its mission in history. The Jews also have their mission. They are the people of religion, that we're spreading this idea of a pure religion and everything, all ethical monotheism, basically. And in line with this, the conference said we're going to get rid of prayers for the restoration of sacrifices, which is honest. They don't believe in a return to Israel. They don't believe in a building of the temple. So clearly they don't believe in a return to sacrifices, which they saw as barbaric. So ancient man needed sacrifices. We don't need sacrifices. So that is also removed from their prayer book. Incidentally, in case any of you are fans of Yeshayahu Leibovitz, who's full of interesting ideas, I don't know if you call him orthodox, orthoprax, whatever he is, but certainly he's halachic, but his ideas are really way out there. Fascinating, but way out there. He said, I don't know where you put what I'm going to tell you now, if where you put this on the scale of acceptable or not. He says that it's very important to believe in the coming of the Messiah, but the Messiah that actually comes is a false Messiah. In other words, Leibniz's point was that the Messiah can never actually come. That's the false Messiah. The whole notion of the Messiah is always hoping for a better future, because the future can always be better. Even if you think it's great now, it can always be better. So that's what it's all about, making the world better. If you ever think you've arrived, then that's the false Messiah. So that's, I guess, denial of the traditional idea of the Messianic era. But he thinks that that's the Rambam's approach, and at least the Rambam's secret approach. But it's very striking. The Messiah that arrives is the false Messiah by definition, because funny that Elliot Wolfson, genius, what a genius this guy is, but how he knows everything he knows, I don't know. So he writes a book on Chabad. In addition to everything else he writes, how he masters every piece of Chabad, I don't know. His argument, this is so ironic, his argument in this book, and he's talking about Chabad, which brought Messianism, instead of being something what Gershom Scholem spoke about, the neutralization of Messianism and Hasidut, and Chabad brings it not just unneutralize it, they make it into a reality where they even crown a living figure and then continue with a dead figure, some of them, as the Messiah. Elliot Wolfson writes this whole deeply learned book, and he claims that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in all his talk about the Mashiach, and he did speak, he was actually neutralizing the idea of a personal Messiah. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe's secret teaching is that there is no personal Messiah, that it's all it's all the Messianic era. That's all we can hope for, and that's all that we need. There was an interview with one of the big Chabadnikim after this book came out in Crown Heights, and he said it's a great book. 90% is right on the mark, right on target, but in this area, Wolfson's way off. And the truth is, I can't see how Wolfson can be right about this. I can't imagine Lubavitcher Rebbe diverging from such a basic principle, not to mention the fact you read what Lubavitcher Rebbe says. I don't see it. But that's Elliot Wolfson. Problem is, it's hard to understand Elliot Wolfson, the way he writes. You have to read each sentence over five times. You've seen some of these postmodern ways of writing. It's many of the sentences are incomprehensible. I can read you some examples of his sentences. I'm going to say it's my lack, but I mean the verbiage is such that I can't understand it. The Frankfurt Conference also instituted a 3-year cycle for reading the Torah. I haven't been able to determine this. I think it's a real 3-year cycle. That is, you complete the Torah reading in a 3-year cycle, not what the conservative movement did. The conservative movement did this thing, which is completely fraudulent. They adopted the triennial cycle, but the triennial cycle, in ancient times, there was two ways of reading it. There's the way we read it, and then you complete it in 3 years. The triennial cycle meant that you completed the whole Torah in 3 years. It didn't mean that you read, let's say, Parshas Nitzavim, the first third of it this year, and then next year, the second third of it, and then the third year. But the conservative movement was stuck with a problem. They couldn't have a situation where in their synagogues, because not all the synagogues, by the way, went with the triennial cycle, but they couldn't have a situation where the conservative synagogues were reading a different portion of the week. So what are we at? So Nitzavim, let's say, they couldn't have it that this week the Jewish world's reading Nitzavim and the conservatives are not reading it. That would be too much of a break. So they created this triennial cycle, which is, it's really phony because it's not, you don't complete the Torah in a year and you're not reading it in order. So you just do three Aliyahs and the next week, another three Aliyahs. I don't know, really, I don't know how many synagogues do that because I know my cousin's conservative synagogue reads the whole Torah reading. If any of you know how popular the triennial cycle is and if they all do this way, I remember when they first came out with this, David Novak, who was part of the conservative movement, right? He wrote a, I think it was a responsum or an article stating that you do not fulfill your obligation by this, he called it a faux triennial cycle, I believe. So I don't know. Do the conservative synagogues still do this triennial cycle? If anyone knows, let me know. And the last thing I want to mention about this conference, they decided that it's permissible to have an organ played by a Jew. If you remember the first generation of Reform, yes, an organ, but played by a non-Jew. Now, by the second generation, an organ played by a Jew. So the halachic era, if you want to call it this, of Reform was one generation. By the second generation already now, and I understand it because the people were not observant. Next week we'll talk about what they also have to say about mikvah. You say, what does Reform have to do with mikvah? You'll see. The mikvah is still an issue they deal with, and then we'll get into the Breslau conference and Yom Tov Sheni. Because that then becomes an issue. For whatever reason, they didn't discuss Yom Tov Sheni at number one and two, but Yom Tov Sheni is going to come at the third conference. Also, Bris Mila. Well, what about Bris Mila? Remember, Geiger said Bris Mila is a barbaric act. Well, so we'll get into that as well. So we still have a little more to do with the conferences. Let me take the questions and comments. Mishra says the HNR, they've been doing it for about 3 years. I assume you're referring to the musical Slichos. Just Google, go to YouTube and plug in musical Slichot. You'll see all the ones that for some reason my computer didn't want to play. But I think the first was the Karlbach. Karlbach's been doing it for 20 years, I think, the Karlbach. I know at HR with Ellie Kranzler, but Karlbach has been doing it since I lived on the West Side. But the Karlbach and HIR are unusual shuls. But my shul did not do that this year. Instead, they had a kumsitz before Slichot. But it'll be interesting to see whether, because the modern Orthodox don't care about the Gedolim in Israel, the Haredi Gedolim banning it. The question is, are the American Haredim, who it's become quite popular now in certain shuls, are they going to stop it? I doubt it. Mel says Rav Soloveitchik was opposed to saying Slichos before Chatzos. So Mel, are you saying that about every night or just the first night? The first night of Slichos, because it's pretty popular, pretty common to say
every
Slichos.
Night.
So say 10
every
o'clock.
Night.
What?
Every night.
Every night. So he would say it in the morning?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The time okay, before is not an appropriate time.
I think the Rav also felt to say it in the morning was inappropriate. I think I was actually recently listening to a talk of the Rav himself, Slichos, and he talks about Slichos is only at night. It's a form of them that you only say at night. There's no such thing as Slichos in the morning. I don't know what he did in practice at YU or whatever, but he felt between Chatzot and Amud HaShachar. And when I was in YU, they said Slichos at 1 o'clock in the morning. That was, they also said in the morning, but they said at one.
I will look into the role. I have to look into Rav Schechter's works to see what his reason is, because as far as I know, the Rav might have a different lundus, but classically, this is because of the Ari. The Ari says it has to be after Chatzos. And yes, you said all the shuls in Edison. Now, it's, we'll see whether it starts changing. Interesting. Interesting. about that. What his point was about the pasuk there, it would have said, it should have been, he said, the hevet. And that's what he's speaking to Rivka. And that's what appears in the Peshitta and some manuscripts of the Samaritan. So Geiger's point was that makes Yaakov speak disrespectfully to his mother. You're going to bring a curse on me. So they changed it. And he says, and the proof is that we still have these two translations. They preserve the original. It's far out there. It's not like the example I showed you where Itrem versus Itra, where you have it in every single translation and the Targum and the Bavli and Yerushalmi. As Rav Chaim Heller mentions, this can be explained in other ways as well. Ruth says, Rabbi Schwartz's understanding of Dina Midrash is spot on. Perhaps if Yaakov had trusted her instincts, she could have had a positive impact on Esav. That's what Rashi says there, but it's a very strange Rashi. That's why Rabbi Schwartz takes it up. Because aren't we supposed to marry our daughters off to someone who we check out, who's a good guy, not supposed to take a chance on someone who we don't know, especially someone like Esav, who's had... Look, we send out guys to do Kiruv in these areas. We don't marry on the assumption that we're going to turn them around. And there's another Maimar in the Gemara that says you shouldn't marry an Amaret. So he takes up that passage. It's an interesting passage, but it is striking his insight that he thinks really the issue here is Dina. Yaakov isn't worried about Esav. He's worried about Dina. That's the problem, but we don't say it.
But his punishment was, instead of having his daughter married to the son of Yitzchak and Rivka, who was circumcised and is a descendant of Avram, she ends up married to a goy, an uncircumcised Kenani.
But you would think that he could have found maybe a better person. Esav is not so good. But what you say is Rashi. Hold on. What you say is, I mean, that's Rashi is. It's not he didn't make this up. He's citing the Midrash. He says that as a punishment, he was punished for not helping Esav come back, and therefore she fell into Shechem. So
she didn't marry Shechem.
But why, he says, but why would they, why would Chazal, that's what Rabbi Schwartz is discussing. Why? Why go that direction? It just seems like it's, he makes a distinction between different types of Amoratzim. He says that Esav is not, Esav doesn't know anything, but Esav is not really a bad guy. That's what he says. He had certain good midos. He was shalem b'mitzvos kibud av v'eim. He cites Rashi Gamliel that says that speaks to how great Esav was doing kibud av v'eim. And so his point is that according to this approach, Esav wasn't really this bad. Remember, if you just look in the Chumash, Esav's not so bad.
I believe
he becomes bad by the time you get through the Midrash. He's turned into bad. He's made into Rome. And we know that Rome is as bad as you can get. But if you just read the Pshat, he's really not so bad. He's not so great, but he's not so bad. He's turned into bad. So it could be that this Midrashic reading is going up the Pshat that he really isn't so bad. He just needs someone good like Dina to guide him in the proper way. Yeah.
Exactly.
So thank you. That's exactly. Very nice. Susanna says she once met a Christian clergy who was intermarried. You have a Muslim clergy who are intermarried, and that's allowed, and it's allowed. Christian clergy are allowed to be intermarried, and you have Reformed clergy who are intermarried and Reconstructionists, and it's allowed for them as well. It's a big issue. I shouldn't say it's allowed because it's a big issue. There are those who are, but it's a big issue at HUC and at the Reconstructionist. Should they allow into the rabbinical school people who are intermarried? And there are those who say no, and that's the official policy at HUC, as I believe right now. But a lot of the students are opposed to this. They say it's discriminatory. But you have people who already have become rabbis, and then later intermarry. Now, M.H. Lazerson says, every survey has shown that the offspring of mixed marriages, regardless of all question, are unlikely to be involved in Judaism for more than one generation. Indeed. And privately, someone mentions that his mother was one of the few survivors of Michelstadt. She left in 37. If you go to Michelstadt, you see the shul, which has been rebuilt, and you see you can go to the kever of the famous the Baal Shem of Michelstadt. And the correct pronunciation is Michelstadt, with German. But in Yiddish, we say Michelstadt, because it's with a chaf. Martin says, the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale has had musical service for years, and Eli Kranzler, yes. I haven't gone, but there's someone in my town who goes. The problem is that HIR, at least as of before COVID, their slicho started at 12:50. So you're not getting back to West Orange till like maybe 2:33 in the morning. So I never had the koach to do that. Yes, and Lazerson said the vast majority of Reform Jews have never set foot in Israel. Yeah, it's a problem. But the Reform movement as a whole is very supportive of Israel. They established a kibbutz, and they are supportive. Whether the next generation will still be supportive remains to be seen. But right now, they are supportive. And privately, someone says that Rosh Hashanah Hirsch at one point was going to be rabbi of New Orleans.
I made a mistake on that. He wrote Shuvas from New Orleans.
I was going to say, I never heard of this New Orleans. He wrote from Rabbi Illowy. Thinking of Rabbi Bernard Illowy. Right. In the Tshuvot, in the Sefer published by Rabbi Bernard Illowy, He corresponds halachically with both Hirsch and also with Rabbi Adler from London. Just quickly going through it. Yes, I know the yarmulke of King Charles, the yarmulke he wears. Mel says that in May 2021, 90 Reform rabbinical students signed a letter accusing Israel of apartheid. Yes, there's been... was it only Reform or also Reconstruction? There's a problem. There's no question. There's a problem. And you have a, I think it's a Reform, but maybe it's New Age. I don't know what it is. There's this synagogue that's been making waves. I think it's in California because they claim to be an officially anti-Zionist synagogue. And when I say anti-Zionist, I don't mean anti-Zionist like Satmar anti-Zionist. I mean, although they would say probably that we're just like Satmar. Eric says, "What is the Deuteronomic prohibition for marriage limited to Canaanite people from pure biblical perspective?" That's alpi pshat, but it's understood that refers to everyone. In other words, we assume that intermarriage is not just a rabbinic prohibition, although you can make that case, I guess, if you just want to argue pshat. We assume that intermarriage is a Torah prohibition. Quickly, Lazerson says that one leading conservative rabbi said the triennial cycle was essential to keep the pews full. Long service would empty the pews. Well, there's another solution. You can cut out other things, or you can cut the sermon down a little bit.
But would you say?
So Eric says that in the movement, some do triennial, but they do it with 7 aliyot, not 3. But they. But when they do it, they're only doing the 3. Correct me if I'm wrong, Eric. They're doing 7 aliyot for the first three aliyos. That's what they're doing.
It's not exactly. Right? It's not exactly broken by the aliyot. They have their own way of breaking it.
They don't complete it the next week. They just do a third of it. Speaking of aliyot, last week was an interesting thing because we had the tochacha, and people don't want to get aliyos for the tochacha. So because they're nervous that, this is all these terrible things. And we read the Tochacha quietly, which I never understood because why read it silently? I never understood that. You'd think that you'd read it loud. You want people to hear. This is what happens. This is a punishment if you don't. But we know that in Europe, they would only give the rabbi this aliyah because people were afraid. And I don't know if in your shuls they still do that, but that was a common practice. Now, one thing we also know is there was a minotos. You had shuls without rabbis, like in Vilna, you'd have lots of shuls. So you'd have the shul of the carriage drivers and the shul of the tailors. There was a practice for that aliyah. What is it? It's 6. Yeah, 6 aliyah, not to call anyone up. Just after the 5th aliyah, then the Baal Kore just continues reading. And the rabbis attack this. This is wrong. This is a minhotos. You have to call someone up. You can't just continue reading. But no one wanted to get an aliyah. And therefore, since no one actually wanted to get an aliyah, therefore they developed this minhag that they would just read it. And Ruth says, just two more minutes. Ruth says in the Adas show, the Adas Yisrael show in Washington, the big show, still does the Traino cycle. They read one third of each parsha each week. Yeah, so they're reading what the rest of the Jewish world is. The problem is, if it's the second year, then you'll start in the middle. And Rabbi Shugnow says many temples became synagogue instead of temples. Yes. Now, Lazer says, when did the Sephardic and Ashkenazic practices and Slichos begin to differ? I assume you're talking about the month. I don't know. Okay, I'll look, Avi, later. I'm going to look into, you say, Aruch Chaim, when the Slichos is supposed to be. Mel says the standard practices for the Baal Kriya to read the Toch HaYomi to get the Aliyah for it. That would be because I've seen rabbis get it in where I've been. They give it to the rabbi. But the same thing for the Baal Korei, because he's already reading it. So when you get the Aliyah, you're just reading it. But the point is that you used to have it where the Baal Korei didn't take the Aliyah. He just read it. And that's a Minhag Tos. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. I'll find out more about the Slichos, the Rav's sheet on this. I'll also look at what the Shulchan Aruch says. Look, the Ari says, 100% the Ari says it has to be after Chatzos. But are there non-Kabbalistic reasons as well? Okay, Rabbi, coming.
Thank you. By the way, talking on musical Slichos, just here in Toronto the last 2 years, I was actually listening to part of it. When a sort of a breakaway conservative show with a world-class, you know, chazen, they had Slichos on the radio, 96.3, which is a classic station here. I don't know what it compares to in New York, the radio station of classical music. And they have the person who hosts a lot of their show introduce the Slichos. It's actually quite beautiful. What can I say? It's with a choir, a female choir, a violinist, a world-class cousin, and they broadcast the Slichos. They introduce and this tune by Shlomo Carlbach, and they'll talk about it. It's really, you know,
Rabbi Kelman, in the rabbi's letter, they say that you turn Slichos into a musical. Right.
Yeah, I agree. It's very in. The two, the Beit had it here in Toronto this year. They started with music.
I know, the Beit has. You can go online. You can see it's Beit from last year. They had a Aruch Chaim musical one.
Did it for the first time. Aruch Chaim School did a musical Slichos. I went to a regular shul, clan, whatever. I was 10 o'clock Slichos all over the place. All the two biggest, or the Beit also had a 10 o'clock Slichos and a 1 o'clock Slichos.
No, but I get if you're singing along and they're playing the guitar, I get it. But if it becomes a show.
Right. Obviously, this is talking. I was talking with the one on the radio. It's a show. It's not really davening. Yeah.
But Karabakh is not a show. And HAR
right.
And the ones
I understand.
I'm
right. I'm just saying. I also found it fascinating while I was sort of, you know, searching on YouTube a little bit. How many Reform shuls had Slichos? And I spent, I guess, I went to Slichos at Chatzot the first night. The rest of the week, I'm not so machmir. But the first night, I waited till Chatzot. And so I was watching Slichos on YouTube, these Reform shuls. I thought it's unbelievable. I really think that, can you imagine Reform shuls today? A Slichos, a shul in Jacksonville, and one in Georgia. Yeah. You know, the rabbi or the, you know, male rabbis, female rabbis, chazan. But the fact that they have a Slichos service in a Reformed, you know, temple, shul, whatever you want to call it, I just find that really quite amazing. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe other people don't agree with me, but I think that's, I mean, amazing in a positive sense. Going back to tradition that, you know, that Reform has Slichos. Wow. And they talk about, you know, tshuva and return. It's not exactly like our slichas, but they do the shlosh esrei midot, and it's Hebrew and English and really anyway. So.
By the way, everyone, look in your art scroll sitter. They're all. It says on it. I don't know if they've corrected it yet. That you recite these six verses out loud. There's no six verses. It's the four verses you recite out loud. And then there's the one that no one recites.
You mean?
Yishmak Kolena. Then there's the one that no one recites, which I don't know why. But Art Scroll Sitter, for years they've had, and they reprinted it numerous times, and it still says this six. It should be four.
The most famous problem with Slichos, of course, is Rav Soloveitchik was very makbid on Yom Kippur, that we don't have Slichos at Shachrit, Mincha, and Musa. For Rav Soloveitchik, thought that was very, very wrong. And if anybody's ever been to YU for Yom Kippur, YU has Slichos at Shachrit, Musaf, and Mincha. Yom Kippur has to have Slichus all five, and it's, I think they say it's based on a printer mistake. You know, the printer puts something, you know, to say in and whatever, but we only say Slichus, a Kol Nidre and Ne'ila, but that's not, the Rav is very, very much opposed to what do with 99% of shuls across the world.
If you look at the old Machzorim, and it's still in many of the Western European Minhagim, Slichus are said at Mincha and at Shachris.
Right.
I think when because
yes, the reason is because each community had its own Slichos. So the printers put in Tanhurim Slichos.
Right.
Each community would then go ahead and say whatever Nusach it had. But then it just fell away, and there no one says Slichos. In Tinek and Rinat, Rabbi Adler's shul, now Rabbi Strachler's shul, we do say Slichos at Shachris. We have a booklet. We have a booklet now. They printed it. It's a hardcover book where we pass out and everybody, and we say Slichos. We say three times Yud Gimel Midos. Right. But Abraham here also does it with Rabbi Neuberger.
Okay, from the Y influence of the Rav. In Toronto, I'm not aware of shuls that do. Maybe there are, I'm not aware of any. And it's also, that's the proof is in Shema Kolenu. In other words, which is sort of the conclusion of Slichos. We still say Shema Kolenu at Shachrit Musaf and Mincha, and it doesn't really make sense if you're not saying like Slichos to say Shema Kolenu. But,
yeah, because that part of the whole Slichos uniform.
Exactly, 100%. What you say.
You go to the Goldschmidt Machzor for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, especially for Yom Kippur, has thousands of different Slichos.
Right.
Literally thousands of different Slichos for Yom Kippur. And they, you know, he breaks it down as to where they were said, Eastern Germany, Western Germany, all France, Italy, all over the place.
Maimonides also says Slichos, Shachar bin Chamar instead of Rosh.
Okay, interesting. But all right, I mean, I imagine in most shuls you introduce extra slicha shachar mincha maariv, it must have not going to go over well. You know, people learn. Okay, they understand. But to balabatim, we're going to now have slichas. Musaf, they'll shoot you. You know, like
that's. So I forgot to do next. We have to wish everyone a Shana Tova, and
that's right. Next Monday night, we're in shul.
Not going to be here.
Back in 2 weeks. 2 weeks, sort of Arab.
Siva Tova and all the good things. Yep. Okay. So 2 weeks, Mir Hashem.
Correct. 2 weeks. Okay. Please, God, everybody, be well. We'll see you rest of the week. Two shirim tomorrow, all through the week. Our regular shirim, 11 o'clock tomorrow. Gila Rosen, Rabbi Berger at 1 p.m. and et cetera through the week. And we look forward to learning with you. And like we say, those who don't see, and everybody, Ktiva b'chetima tova, Shana tova. Okay. And I miss the early Slichus tonight, even if I wanted to go, because they say to my shul at 9:45, they say Slichus and during the week. But anyways, I'll say in the morning. Okay, we'll do in the morning. What can we do?
Laila Tov also.
Laila Tov, everybody. Be well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.